Welcome to this episode of Statum, a podcast for clinical partners. I'm your host, Richard Schooley. By now, you know the purpose of this podcast is to connect dots that may not be apparent. You can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're going to step into HRO, or the High Reliability Organization Journey, with Dr. Deb Peterson and Joe Mercury.
We were just getting ready for dinner last night, and my daughter called and said, "Don't panic, Mom, but Gus had an ATV rollover, and the helicopter's on the way to the end of our driveway."
That was Dr. Deb Peterson. Gus is her grandson. I asked Deb to share a safety story with me, and I expected one from the hospital or the clinic. And we're going to get into this topic of high reliability by starting with safety, as it seems to be the front door into any explanation about high reliability. But while safety is central to high reliability, it is only one part of a bigger system. Think about the airline industry for a moment. If it wasn't safe to fly from city to city, if planes were dropping out of the sky, no one would fly. But consider for a moment all that goes into creating that kind of safety and reliability. I mean, there's remarkable engineering. There are safety systems and redundant safety systems. There's expertise, people who know their roles, air traffic control, administrative processes, so many moving parts, and yet they all work together. So much so that it is safer to get on a plane than it is to drive to work in your car. The airline industry is an example of high reliability. Okay, I'm going to shift the metaphor. I want you to think of a Rubik's Cube. You know, it has six sides, right? And when it's all put together, there's one color per side. Red, blue, green, yellow, white, orange. Now let's imagine that this Rubik's Cube is a healthcare HRO. One side is safety. Another is the practice of medicine, the quality of your care. A third side is eliminating waste, like the things in the course of your day that keep you from doing your best work. Improvement is the fourth side. Improvement as a mindset, improvement as a science, that kind of discipline. The fifth side is systems and subsystems. I mean, think about the complexity of a computer operating system or even the operating system for a Tesla car. And finally, the sixth side is psychological safety, a culture where it is 100% safe to speak up. The thing we know about a Rubik's Cube is that typically the colors are all mixed together. You can't pull it apart. Those nine little squares on every side are part of a bigger whole, and that's an HRO. High reliability is the sum of many parts. So if we start with safety, we're going to naturally bump into the other parts of a healthcare HRO. Here's Deb's story. Listen for the normalized deviance.
So the worst case scenario, of course, is running through my mind. We had just been over there 2 weeks before, and the kids were zipping here, there, everywhere. They wear helmets. They wear a seatbelt in the go-kart. Gus took feed down to the cows on the farm ATV. Normalized deviance. I do this all the time. And it has a seatbelt. He could have had a helmet on. He did not. He turned too quickly down by the cows and tipped over in the ditch. Thankfully, was thrown free. We could have had so much worse, I guess, is what I'd say. And I, like I said, I think about how farm equipment like that is viewed as something safe. I mean, there's so many things we do in life that we view as safe and routine. He feeds the cows every day. Every day we take care of patients. And we have patients that have what we would call routine heart failure or a routine appendectomy, and things can go wrong. And if we're not preoccupied with what could go wrong and situational awareness, bad things can happen. And that was brought home to me last night. I mean, the other part of it that I think about, and I think probably Joe does too, is, you know, would this have happened if I was the bad grandma and had spoken up and said, be sure you always put your seatbelt on, even with the farm ATV. Be sure you wear your helmet. And I chose not to be the bad grandma and say anything at the birthday party and ruin it for everybody. But gosh, how many times do those things happen in life? So
Deb, I actually think that this idea of being the bad grandma, the heavy, you know, mm-hmm. is really an interesting one for us to talk about, because it's the idea of speaking up.
Yep, exactly.
And having the courage to speak up, no matter what the situation is or the perception might be. And like, it's an unexpected turn in the story, because you were just there 2 weeks ago for the birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And did you see them without helmets?
No, but they were flying over the driveway on the dirt bike. I mean, they were being kids. They had their safety equipment on for the dirt bike. They did not have it on for the ATV. Did the dirt bike make me nervous too? Sure, because I've seen broken legs and this and that with that. But kids have to be kids too. I laid awake almost all night last night thinking, would it have been different if either myself or my husband had said something, you know, but can't go back.
Can't go back, but I'm glad that there's a happy ending to that story. It doesn't sound like there's a bad ending to that story.
So far, no. He should be in the hospital probably just one more day, and we'll be good, so.
Fantastic. Keep us posted, Deb. Okay, let's switch now to Dr. Joe Mercury. Joe, you've got a different kind of safety story.
All right. Hope it's okay, but I did write it down because of the things I may refer to notes. But so this is a story about an error that I made that ultimately let a patient down. So years ago, I was taking care of a patient, John, as I remember his first name was. Here's a patient who was admitted with a GI bleed to the hospital, actually to the intensive care unit, pretty sick when he came in. So, of course, had to take care of the GI bleed, all the associated medications, call the gastroenterologist, and we finally got John taken care of. His bleeding stopped. He did well, transferred out to the floor. And, you know, I was getting ready to discharge John, and he said, you know, doc, I've had this cough for like 3 weeks. Maybe it's even a few months. It's like, well, which one is it, weeks or months? And he's like, oh, it's months, I guess. So of course, my concern was a little picked, if you will. So I said, you know what, you're getting ready to go home today, but just to be on the safe side, why don't we get a chest X-ray? I'll do the discharge orders, and you will, you can get discharged. If I see anything on the chest X-ray, we'll call you at home. So I went about the patient got a chest X-ray, went home. I do my usual standard work of the day, taking care of all my other patients, and frankly forgot to check the chest X-ray that was obtained prior to discharge. And as these things kind of go, once you forget it that day, you forget it other days, and it just faded into the distance. So fast forward about 6 months or so, I see one of my pulmonary colleagues, Dr. Lavelle, in the hallway, and he kind of grabs me aside and says, hey, just want to let you know I saw John the other day. He had to remind me who that was. And I said, oh, you did? What did you see him for? So, well, the chest X-ray that you obtained had bilateral pulmonary masses, and so basically has advanced lung cancer, and he had it back then. So I... frankly, this haunted me for some time, missing this. I basically delayed the patient's diagnosis of cancer, possibly prevented treatment being done earlier. And, you know, I was not worried about the litigation standpoint at that point, or the litigation issues at that point. I was more worried about what I had done to the patient. And, you know, with true sincerity of thought, I really thought, well, this is all my fault. And I went around walking around days thinking it's my fault. But then another reality dawned on me, frankly, that in a way our system had failed this patient as well, because we didn't have fail states. We didn't have stop gaps to make sure that that chest X-ray, which was abnormal, would have been caught if me, myself and my human frailty missed that. You know, and there's a number of different mechanisms by way that would have occurred, but none of them were there. Now, let me be clear that, you know, you order a study as a physician, you're responsible for following up on it. So the fault ultimately and responsibility ultimately lies with myself, but one can think that the greater responsibility is us as physicians also contributing to the development of systems whereby those mistakes don't occur.
Okay. So I got a question for you, Deb, as a doctor. When you hear that story, what strikes you?
The part of it that really strikes me is that Joe hurts because he feels like he let the patient down.
Yeah.
You know, there's that doesn't happen in an emotional vacuum. It happens in a very personal way. And he is correct. The system, we are humans, and we talked about it at noon today. We fail. We get busy. Life is complex. We fail. And we have to be able to use the system to make it as safe as possible to keep us as safe as possible. And that's what I thought of when he was telling his story.
Yeah, I think that's what struck me as well. First time I heard it was, and I know you only a little bit, Joe, but I feel like through our various conversations over the years, I know the man you are. And there's no way for me to separate the man you are from the physician you are in that story.
Yeah.
Right? Because the man you are hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the physician, do no harm, hurts as well. But what I hear is the man.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think so. I think we do very well as physicians separating, partitioning our physician life from our home life and our leisure life, et cetera. But ultimately, they're all interconnected and intertwined. And I listen to music. I can have emotions listening to music that remind me of medical experiences I've had. So that just shows you how deep,
mm-hmm.
Deep the water is. So I think, it is true. And, you know, to that point, there's only like four or five of those stories that we all have that haunt us. And it may not be about a misdiagnosis or a error. It might be about your own human failing of not being able to empathize with somebody, dismissing somebody's concerns. And, you know, I mean, I think the other doctor on this call is probably one of the most empathetic people I know, but I bet I would be willing to bet that she's had a bad day, you know, so.
Indeed.
Oh, I have. And my bad days often come out, you know, you can give it all at work, and where it ends up suffering is at home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And we don't want that, right? Because you got to come back and do it again tomorrow. And, and it's you only get to live this one life. Joe, when you said, frankly, I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like to me, that resonated through, because we've all just forgotten something. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you said, and then it faded into the distance. And that we all know happens as well.
Yeah.
But the stakes are not so high on my to-do list as they are on a physician's to-do list. Right. And that to me is the part that is so honest in this story. That is the way in which, when we turn in the story to the system, there's a word that I wrote down, which is depend.
Mm-hmm.
We like to be much stronger than this. We want it to be interdependent. We want to be independent. We want to be authoritative, et cetera. It ultimately comes down to this idea that we depend on each other.
Yep.
And if there wasn't a flag in Epic, if there wasn't somebody else to take a look at it, then you're all alone.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us can do this alone.
Yeah. And then, I mean, probably in the inpatient setting, it's somewhat, maybe a little different, but not really. I mean, and Deb, you can tell me because you work in both worlds, but the people we depend most on are nurses and frontline caregivers.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, yes, we depend on that radiologist to call us with an abnormal finding sometimes, but, it's just in our frontline caregivers' DNA mm-hmm. to, you know, look out for us. And they have to have the systems in order to do so as well.
Right. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying completely. I mean, they are our eyes, our ears, our hands at the bedside, you know, 12 hours a day. And we're there maybe, what, 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
And if we don't view it as teamwork and there's a power gradient in there at all, it's not going to work. It just is not going to work.
And it could work so much better. This is the bad grandma moment.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is where we want them to speak up regardless.
Exactly.
This is psychological safety, because you are a team and you depend on each other. And these patients depend on all of you. So I know we need to wrap it up, but I wonder if there's anything more either of you would like to say.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I think we want our partners to all understand what is at the heart of HRO, not that the head knowledge doesn't matter if you don't have it in here.
That's right.
Our guests today have been Dr. Deb Peterson, who is the physician executive for the Southwest region. Deb has been practicing as a family physician in a rural community for 35 years. And Dr. Joe Mercury, who is the section director of hospital medicine at St. Cloud Hospital. Joe was one of the founders of the original hospitalist group at St. Cloud Hospital and, little known fact, was a concert pianist before becoming a doctor.
I did not know that.
Deb, Joe, I want to thank you very much for how human you are in your stories, how you show up and serve your patients and each other. It's really a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here today.
Next week, we'll talk with Dr. Chris Thompson about primary care transformation. Until then, take good care. Thank you.